CFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with old Labour economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Five years ago, Bristol City Council prefabs by the Downs were rebuilt with new roofs, new central heating systems, and then the tenants were evicted. And those prefabs have been falling to bits ever since. That was about 4 years ago, and now they've been. Now we visit the site with council tenants to question the neglect of our housing stock in the city, while homeless Bristolians are forced to sleep in car parks. Plus, we continue the series on censorship, documenting MI5's presence at the BBC. What were they up to there, going through the corporation's personnel files? And can we believe the Director General of the BBC when he promises us they don't select their staff based on their politics? But first, thanks very much to John Keeley, who's a Lib Dem councillor for Easton, in the first part of the show. But Martin Summers is still with me here. Martin, I think one of the things I'd like to look at right at the very start now is the potential new leaders of Egypt, now Hosni Mubarak has disappeared. Can you just give us an idea of the sort of political layout, the kind of territory, what's going on over there?
Well, obviously, I'm no expert on Egypt. I've been following it in the news, and I knew a bit about it before. I mean, I presume that this Omar Suleiman has taken over because he was the vice president. He, of course, is a thug, as big a thug as Mubarak. So removing Mubarak in a way is a kind of doesn't change the fundamentals of the regime.
But you're quite good on the history in Egypt, aren't you? Can you just give us an idea of how we've got to this point where there's this guy who's clinging to power like a limpet and is finally gone?
Well, the main change in Egyptian policy in the 50s and the early 60s until the 67 war with Israel, Abdel Nasser used to run Egypt, and he was a great sort of charismatic ex-military national populist, really. And Egypt at that time was a leader in the Arab world, led against the Israelis, and of course Nasser got fantastic popularity over defeating Britain in 1956. Britain was defeated by Egypt in 1956. That gave Britain, France and Israel were defeated, and that gave him immense credibility. But with his defeat in the 67 war by the Israelis, he lost a lot of credibility, and gradually Egypt was then manoeuvred back into the pro-Western camp. And Mubarak has pursued a very pro-American, pro-capitalist policy ever since. But of course, it's impoverished large sections of the population, who are extremely fed up with it.
What about the other candidates? Are there any really people who aren't actually associated with the security state?
I mean, there's Mohammed El-Baradei, who's been seen as who's the International Atomic Energy Agency inspector in Iraq, who tried basically to talk the Americans out of attacking Iraq by pointing out the fact that Saddam didn't have any weapons of mass destruction. They ignored him. But he's got a great deal of credibility in kind of middle-class liberal circles, not just in Egypt, but across the region and even in the West. How much support he's got on the ground inside Egypt is another question. The biggest political force that people know about is the Muslim Brotherhood, the Ikhwan, founded in the 1920s. And it's a sure bet that if there was a free election, not necessarily that they would win, but they would probably be the biggest single party. But what's very encouraging is that all the opposition forces in Egypt are cooperating very closely, it seems. They're not jostling for power amongst themselves. I think the best outcome for the country would be a government of national unity involving all major political forces. If you're in a mess like that, you don't necessarily need a government which has only got support of, say, 40% of the people, or even 50%. To make a transition, you might want to have a government that represents virtually everybody, so that you can get, for example, the election rules set up, the rules for setting up political parties. They've got to write a new constitution, basically. It's not just have an election. They need to rewrite the constitution, and to do that, you need to have everybody on board. If you think of the Northern Ireland Irish peace process. Everybody had to be included in that for it to work.
So you can't get a constitution off the shelf these days, then? No.
Well, you can. You can get good ideas about things to put in it and what it ought to look like, because you've got other constitutions to look at. But the fact is that the existing constitution clearly is not adequate to the circumstances. Now, you need to draw everybody in if you're going to have a new constitution, don't you?
The Muslim Brotherhood, as you say, possibly if in a new Egypt, maybe the largest single party, but they are associated, aren't they, historically, with the Nazis and Second World War?
Well, yes, and so are many people around. Don't forget, you see, we tend to think of the Second World War as we were the good guys, they were the bad guys, everybody was on their side was bad because we were the good guys. But of course, Britain, in large parts of the world, was regarded as the colonial power. And as the Irish said in World War One, you know, England's difficulty is Ireland's opportunity. And we can't presume that people out there are going to support us. Why would they want to support us if we don't support them? I mean, there's a real issue now that if the West is seen to be backing the current regime and that current regime is overthrown, then whoever wins a democratic election in Egypt is unlikely to be very friendly to our interests or to the interests of our bosses, as it were. And that's pretty much the way it's going to be. I mean, you can see the bullets that are being used to shoot people down are coming from us. And the Egyptian army are all trained at Sandhurst at our expense. So it's not surprising that young Egyptians might conclude that the British are their enemies, because we have been historically quite so. We killed 1,000 civilians when we bombed Fort Sydde in 1956. 1,000 civilians. What if the Egyptians had come here and killed 1,000 of our civilians? How would we feel about that? We wouldn't like it, would we? Well, quite likely they don't like it either.
Well, there are hundreds of thousands of people been demonstrating across Egypt. Some would say even over a million, although there's a little dispute about the figures. Well, what do you think is a real chance that these people are going to get their way? Because there are some interests around the world, very much US and Israeli, possibly even the British, arranged against them, aren't they? That they want what they want, the Egypt from outside. This is the problem, isn't it? When a country's in flux like Egypt is right now, outside pressure, particularly behind the scenes, can be crucial.
Well, of course it can. I mean, the Egyptian army is paid for by US taxpayers to the tune of $1.5 billion per year. So we were talking about cutting libraries there or cutting public services. If the US taxpayer is paying for the tanks and the bullets and all of the repression that's being inflicted on people. It looks like they're also paying for Islamic terrorism, as we were discussing earlier with the bombing of the Alexandrian Cathedral. At a certain point, the West is basically going to come a cropper here, because we've been backing the wrong horse for 30 years. And even if we were to change, if the Western powers were to change their mind right now and decide to do the right thing, which is say, if you don't let these people win, we're going to cut off military aid to you, which is the obvious pressure that the Americans could bring to bear. Even if you did that, people were still likely to feel unhappy because this regime has been imposed on Egypt for 30 years by the Western powers. And at a certain point, when they break free, they're not likely to vote for pro-Western candidates, just as when Poland broke free from the Soviet bloc, they were unlikely to vote for pro-Russian candidates. And there's a very anti-Russian mood in most of the countries of Eastern Europe, even today, a generation later. And you can imagine that in a democratic Egypt, it's unlikely that they're going to have a very positive attitude towards Western interests. They see Western interests as pro-Israel and steal our oil. And do you know what? They're right. That is what the West is about, and therefore they're right to oppose it.
And what about the potential shift in the tectonic plates of Middle Eastern politics? What is the potential outcome here?
Well, the real fear for the Western powers is the revolution in Saudi Arabia, because they've got the world's largest oil supply and quite a big army as well. You see, as in Iran in 1979, if there is a serious democratic revolution, that army with all of its kit falls into the hands of the revolutionaries, and then suddenly that changes the strategic balance completely. And the Saudis fell, they would lose access to Saudi oil. Then a new regime in Saudi Arabia wouldn't price oil in dollars. They'd probably price it in euros. It would create all kinds of problems for the big boys in the West. But then the big boys in the West deserve their problems. They are largely responsible for the mess the world is in. And we need democratic revolutions, not just in Egypt. In Haiti, for example, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the former elected president, is going back to Haiti this week, I understand. The Americans don't like the idea, but then that's just too bad, isn't it?
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Now, since the system for housing the homeless has changed in Bristol from the old housing list to the bid system called choice-based lettings, the problems got worse. Many of the most vulnerable people in the city, desperate for housing, cannot even use a computer to bid. Even though there are some systems, not everyone is able to do this. So people are increasingly housing themselves, and that often means squatting. As reported here 2 weeks ago, the council's former homeless advice centre, the Hub on Cumberland Street, is now occupied by squatters who are open from 12 to 6 p.m. on Saturday to Monday for advice to the public. Anna is one of the organisers.
My name is Anne, and I'm one of the people who are currently occupying what used to be the Hub drop-in centre for homeless people, and that has been reopened by us about 2 weeks ago, and we are now running housing and welfare advice services out of here again, as well as a cafe where people can come have a hot drink and just hang out and get a chat.
Now, the council are saying that they reckon that there's actually only about 7 rough sleepers in the city, so there isn't really a need for a homeless advice centre.
Well, yes, maybe if you take one stroll around the bear pit and 6 or 7 is what you find. In reality, it's probably more around 40, 50. Also, on the two nights, Thursdays and Sunday nights, when the night shelters closed, it's 20 more than that. So that figure of 6 or 7 people is absolutely ridiculous, which every homeless person in this city or anybody who's working with the homeless will tell you as well. The definition of who is really homeless is quite narrow. For example, who counts as a rough sleeper is only a person who, at the time of counting, is actually bedded down somewhere or about to bed down somewhere outside. So a lot of people would not even figure in such a count. Also, squatters are not being counted as rough sleepers, obviously, although they aren't adequately housed. And there are a number of other situations where there's a sort of grey area in whether or not they're being considered homeless.
Now, through Acts of Parliament, the Housing Act particularly, local authorities do have an obligation to house people. And in Bristol, they now have closed this particular housing advice centre.
They have actually moved all the stuff that used to work at the Hub to a different location. It is, however, not a drop-in centre anymore, but people wanting to use the Hub now have to go through council services first and then get referred to Amelia House, where the Hub now is. And I've personally spoken to a few ex-users of the Hub and also people who were looking for it, and the system seems to be quite confusing and impenetrable for people.
Now, another thing is that the council does have some stock that it's running down to sell the land off. Particularly today, we're looking at Sneed Park. It's about 20 prefabs, which are in actually very good condition. And the council, rather than housing people in there, are selling off the land, bulldozing the prefabs and selling their land off to Bovis Homes for private housing.
Well, yes, I think that is kind of part of an agenda of basically taking public resources away from the public realm, from common possession, and privatising them. But as far as the council is concerned, I think, like, we can't always just point our fingers at the council, because on the other hand, they have spending cuts imposed upon them by the government. They have to implement them in some sort of way, so they have to find some way to do that.
That was Anna from Cumberland Street and the former Bristol City Council Housing Advice Centre, which they're now living in, called The Hub. Now, squatters, many of them musicians, are also holding a 2-day arts and activism event this weekend, and it's a demonstration of what they plan to regularly provide to the local community from a new, larger venue in the future. The workshops this weekend are music production, calligraphy, juggling, mime, Spanish, meditation, crafts and massage. Also, talks on self-sufficiency and music performances with open mic. So if you're a musician, do bring an instrument along. They have film projections and also shadow puppetry. Food and drink, bring your own booze, we're told, is all free. The address this weekend is 54 Fremantle Road, that's Bristol BS6 5SU, 54 Fremantle Road, that's just off Cottam Hill, and the time is 10 a.m. till late, both Saturday and Sunday. P.S. I've got a little P.S. here. Caroline says, bring scissors and pencils and felt tips and rubbers and things like that if you want to do the shadow puppets. If you're homeless, do please go along as well to the event, as they should be able to house you Quite an amazing claim, but certainly worth it if you're homeless, at least for a while. The contact there is Jimmy Marshall. And just to remind you again, that's from 10 till late Saturday and Sunday. The address is 54 Fremantle Road in Bristol. Coming up then is Sneed Park's derelict council allotments, and we've been up there with some council tenants and with some of the local people who walk their dogs through there, talking about what is happening to this site, which has been left derelict for about 4 or 5 years. But first, let's have some music.
Good evening. I would like to report on the state of our war against the American people. We're mounting a sustained campaign to crack down on every American and every person of every faith and every nation, and to bring them to justice. All missions are being executed according to plan, without warning or provocation. Americans are being swept up in an international dragnet. Thousands of FBI agents are on the trail of other citizens here and abroad. It has everything to do with hate and evil and murder and prejudice. America's strong.
Federal agents, we are armed! What would you do with me? You are nothing to me. Won't you stand up for truth? Or would you turn away too? And then what if you saw all of the things that's wrong? Would you stand tall and strong? Or would you turn it all away? What would you do if you knew all the things we knew? Would you stand up for truth? Or would you turn away too? And then what if you saw all of the things that's wrong? Would you stand tall and strong? Or would you turn it away?
A message from the government, like every day I watch it and listen and call them all suckers. They wanted me about Osama or whatever. Picture me buying the scam, I said never. You in tune to a hard truth, soldier spitting. I stay committed, gives a f*** to die, I lose commission. It's all a part of fighting devil state mind control, and all about the battle for your body, mind and soul. And now I'm hoping you don't close your mind so they shape you. Don't forget they made us slaves, gave us AIDS and raped us. Another push season mean another war for profit. All in secret, so the public never seek to stop it. The Illuminati, 666, all connected. Stole the votes, they control the race and take elections. It's the Skull and Bones Freemason Kill Committee. See the dragon get shittier in every city.
What would you do if you knew all the things we knew? Would you stand up for truth? Or would you turn away?
Yourself, who's the one with the most to gain? 4-9-11 motherfuckers couldn't stand his name. Now even niggas waving flags like they lost their mind. Everybody got opinions but don't know the time. Cause America's been took, it's plain to see. The oldest trick in the book is making enemy. A phony evil so the government can do its dirt and take away your freedom, lock and load, beat and search. Ain't nothing changed but more colored people locked in prison. These pigs still beat us but it seems we forgetting. But I remember 4 September how these devils do it. Giuliani asked Diallo how he doing. We in the streets, holler jail to the thief. Follow, waving flags, bring these baggins to their knees. Oil, blood, money, make these killers ride cold. Suspicious suicide, people dying, never told. It's all a part of playing God, so you think we need them. While being Ashcroft, take away your rights to freedom. Bear witness to the sickness of these dictators. Hope you understand the time, brother, cause it's major.
What would you do if you knew all the things we know?
Asking why my records always come the same. Keep it real, ain't no fillers, motherfucker blinging. Mine eyes seen the gory of the coming of the beast. So every story, every word I'm saying, peace. See, you could witness the Illuminati body count. Don't be surprised, these is devils that I'm talking about. You think a couple thousand lies mean shit to killers? Swear to God, we the ones, ain't no villain. Or any other word they think to demonize a country. Ain't no terror threat unless approval rate and slumping. So I'ma say it for the record, we the ones that planned it. Ain't no other country took a part, I had their hand in. Just a way to keep you scary so you think you need them. Praising Bush, why that killer take away your freedom? How many of us got discovered but ignore the symptoms? Niggas talking loud but ain't nobody saying shit.
And with the Fourth Amendment gone, eyes are on the first. That's why I'm spitting cyanide each and every verse. I see the Carlisle Group and Harris bank accounts. I see them plead the Fifth each and every session now. And while White Stag burns, see the public buy it. I see the profiling, see the media's compliance. War's good for business, see the vicious make a savior. Hope you understand the time, brother, cause it's major.
What would you do if you knew all the things we know? Would you stand up for truth? Or would you turn away to heaven? What if you saw all of the things that's wrong? Would you stand tall and strong? Or would you turn and walk away? What would you do if you knew all the things we know? Would you stand up for truth? Or would you turn away to
from 2008, that's Paris with a song called What Would You Do? And yes, music, lyrics, and produced and performed by Paris. Song about 9/11 and some of the implications, things that have happened since. Now, back to the council's, Bristol City Council's housing provision, and council tenants Tom Cook and Jim, plus Sylvia and we're hearing from them in Sneed Park. So let's go over now to Sneed Park, which is just the other side of, well, from here anyway, that's just down towards, out towards the end of the Avon from the Downs. If you go over the top there and go down a little bit, you'll find a place called Sneed Park. It used to be, apparently, the cottage garden of Sneed House. But I went down there with a couple of council tenants, and also we were chatting to some of the people who are walking their dogs in the park nearby.
I'm Jim, a council tenant. I come up here before, about 18 months, 2 years ago, and I'm still surprised to see the prefabs are still here and no work has been done. Notices of closure of footpaths, I've noted, you know, all around us. People we've met are a little bit scared of what's going to happen here. And they say the housing thing is bust. Bovis have got any money to continue with the site. And I would question whether or not BCC are handling this correctly. If this isn't cleared up soon, this has just become a relic and just wasteland, which is a shame because it's a beautiful part of the city.
Well, let's just imagine back 3 years, if the people who were living in here hadn't been told to leave, we could have had 3 years of, 20, 25 prefabs, £50-60 a week. We could have had actually quite a massive income from this site. And also it would have been being lived in and looked after.
But not only the income from the site, the landlord services, general rates, water rates, all the services would have been making money here. At the moment, it's just nothing. Nothing is coming in from this site at all to help any services, any people at all. It really is a shame.
Now, I mean, Sneed Park is one of the most sought-after areas in the city. Land here is incredibly valuable.
It looks as though people like walking their dogs around here. They use it as a doggy walkie trail. And it's only those people that I reckon spot it. I would say if you ask 100 people on the Downs about this site, they wouldn't know. And that is another shocker, really.
And it is actually only, like, literally 2 minutes' walk from the Downs.
Mm. 2 minutes' walk, and you've got a derelict site, which should be one of the prettiest sites around Bristol. It really is a shame.
And you probably find that there's enough space here to house families. You're talking about probably 50, 60 people.
Probably more than that. Modern build, they probably squeeze everybody into little boxes here. They're probably trying to house 300 people. And this, I think, is what the locals are a little bit scared of. They just overpopulate the area. So perhaps there's other issues about this which has not come to the fore.
Be able to walk through from the top, which I think is I don't know.
Completely unnecessary.
Well, I'm Sylvia. I live very near this project, and I don't understand it at all. Why they're doing this? There's not going to be big enough gardens by the time they put some four or five bedroom houses on it, as far as I know. And the block of garages I saw, I thought looked completely out of keeping with the area.
Now, how long have you been walking your dog through here? Because this has been like this for a few years now, hasn't it?
I don't think I'll go into that, but I would say certainly well over 30 years. As far as I know, it belonged to one of the big houses, and it was the garden, but I really don't know what was there before.
For the last two or three years, we could have had paying people living in here, and yet they've been mothballed. So can you think of any reason why that might be?
Well, I presume it was because Bovis thought they could get straight on with it. And, of course, we didn't have the economic troubles when this was all planned, surely. But I still think that if they'd sold it off as separate plots to individuals, they'd have done a lot better.
All the various little footpaths around here are being stopped up. And any time now, we could see gates going up so people can't come through here anymore.
No, I heard that, and I can't see why. Until they actually start work, what's the point in blocking everything off? There's no reason for it. It's just a mess, but the paths are still here, at least. I don't like it as well. You know, they bring their little bikes.
It's a sort of little sanctuary. In fact, it's even called Sanctuary Gardens at the bottom there.
Yes, it is. I don't know where that name came from, but I think it came when they built the prefabs originally.
And apparently for Sneed House, this used to be the cottage garden for it.
I thought it might have been from the old house, yes.
Council housing like this, selling it off, do you think that's acceptable?
I can't see the purpose of it, but not to selling it off to a developer. I don't know anything about Bovis as such, but I think individual ones would have been a lot better and have some a bit variety rather than every house going to be looking very, very similar.
So what would you like to see done with this place?
Well, some nice houses built, obviously, rather than leave it or turn it into an open area, which we'll never do, not with the present council wanting to close all the open areas.
Can you just, you know, go back a few years and tell us what it was like here when the place was actually lived in?
Well, it was very pleasant, well looked after. They had allotments down some of the sides of these paths. Well, of course, there's still one house now which won all sorts of medals for all his garden. But they were, and they were doing them up themselves as well in between. Although I think quite a few were bought from the council. But no, it was a very pleasant area to come. You never felt any worry without any street lights here.
And I suppose if anyone wants to see it, they better do it pretty quick.
I think so, yes.
Now, I'm also joined by Tom.
I think they're unnecessary.
I think the plan's crazy. I don't like the look of it at all.
No. Tom Cook, yeah, council tenant of Frankham House. I think simply, I don't know all the details, but simplistically, this could house a lot of families. And, you know, with the homelessness that exists, this could be housing a lot of families. You know, it's frightening.
Well, what's your impressions of the site? It's the first time you've been here. It's something like, I suppose, maybe 4 acres, about 4 football pitches, and we've got about 20 prefabs, but they've all got quite a bit of space, haven't they?
Yeah, that's how they build prefabs after the Second World War. People didn't have much in the house, but they had a lot of garden. It's a very nice, parky, you know, secluded area, and it's wasted. It's frightening.
Now, one of the things that occurs to me is that this is part of the socialist thing after the Second World War, where the state was going to plan, look after people, care for people, and make sure that everyone was adequately housed, looked after health-wise with the health service and all that kind of thing. Seems like that's all out the window now.
Well, yeah, I mean, people are bothered about being political, but council housing is political, and different political parties have made political decisions in relation to housing, and from the 70s they stopped building council housing and pushed people into owner occupation. I think that's gone now. People who could afford before are worried about their jobs. They don't know whether they're going to have a job next year, and so, you know, people are moving more into rented accommodation. And I think the only answer is council housing again, you know.
Where is it all heading then? If you know, council housing, beautiful bits of land like this that the council has in trust for the people, are just sold off.
Well, I think there's going to be a problem of homelessness, and I don't think that the private building industry in any way can answer that problem. It's only the state that can do anything as far as housing is concerned.
But Tom, you know as well as I do, we're running a massive deficit and we've got to have cuts, so now's maybe not the time.
We've got a Liberal local authority, you know, and, you know, if we go back to that, and I speak ironically, you know, that great revolutionary Keynes, you know, instead of bailing out the bankers, if we built 1 million council houses, you know, we'd have 1 million cookers, 1 million fridges, you know, 1 million curtains, 1 million masses of furniture, you know, and that's not revolutionary, that's just Keynes-like sort of thing, you know, which I thought... roughly what we did after the Second World War in building houses and in building the infrastructure of the country was really following on, you know, although the Labour Party brought it in after the Second World War, it was just carrying out Liberal policies, you know.
And what about the fact that we'll be looking at, say, if you've got 20-25 families in here paying rent over the last 3 years, I mean, the council has lost tens if not hundreds of thousands of pounds in rental income here.
Yeah, I mean, simplistically, yeah. And that's true of all the way around the city, where, you know, where other areas have been lost as well, you know.
There doesn't seem to be any attempt to actually rent these perfectly good, although they are looking a little bit ramshackle now, having been empty for 3 years. I mean, you can see that they've got virtually new roofs, new central heating pipe on the top there. They've been obviously perfectly habitable if someone actually had the will to do it.
Yeah, I don't think there's any misuse. There just isn't any use at all. They're not being used at all, and that's a massive loss. Obviously, you know, rents. But I mean, I look at the families, people who want somewhere to live, you know, and there could be places for them to live. I mean, the structure of prefabricated. You know, we're looking at the roofs. The roofs have, and once you've got a roof covering the building, I can see some felt actually underneath as well, so they've gone, you know, they've been pretty well waterproofed as far as the roof is concerned.
It looks as if these places have been fully refurbished with brand new roofs, brand new central heating and everything, and then everyone has been moved out.
Yeah, well, we wouldn't know the exact details. Obviously there'd be some reason why, you know, they made a decision, but yeah, you know, they look as though people could live here for a period. Yeah, you know, so that even as they are now, there must be some that could be inhabited. But the point is, look at all those families that are homeless, and there's a massive, you know, massive space here for them to live. Like,
why were the people decamped before this issue was resolved properly? Would be the question that should be put to the city council.
Sylvia, who's a local resident, and Tom and Jim, who are both council tenants there with me last week, up at Sneed Park. That's just near the Downs, Clifton Downs. And now Martin Summers is with me. Martin, why is it possible, from an economic point of view, in the middle of a recession, for Bristol City Council to leave 20 or so prefabs just unoccupied for 4 years?
Well, in a sense, you have to ask them that, because I don't know what the decision-making process was.
You know, what kind of thing?
I would guess that they're probably thinking in terms of... It's Sneed Park is extremely desirable, probably the highest value land in the city, and that land with prefabs on it will probably bring in a few rents or whatever, but if you sold it off to developers, you could probably get quite a large amount of money for doing that. And I presume that whoever's made this decision has presumed that when they get money for selling it off for development, that will then help to defray you know, costs and expenses elsewhere in the council's budget. But of course, the killer thing here is, how are we going to house people on low incomes? Because there doesn't seem to be any strategy for that, and there hasn't been for about 30 years.
But I mean, surely that's stoking up social problems, isn't it, for the future?
It is, but unfortunately the political system is geared in favour of those who have rather than those who have not. We all know that those who are least likely to vote are those on the lowest incomes, and gradually over time that erodes the political system. And therefore you get a situation where, I mean, you know, council housing in a way, and all the council houses that were built after the war by the Labour government created what some would call a a dependent vote. I mean, if you've got, if you're getting a nice cheap rent and a nice house, and the Labour Party provided it for you, well, you're being encouraged to vote Labour, aren't you? And I think that the decision to sell off council housing by the Thatcher government in the 80s was political as well. If we get them to buy their own houses, which basically means giving away the houses at a lot less than they're actually worth, and allowing people to profit from that, then they will vote Conservative, and that was the calculation. I think the problem with not having any proper social housing is that it encourages property booms, which then go bust, which then wrecks manufacturing industry, which then means that you can't compete. And this, you know, using housing as a political football in this way is to try and, you know, either by the Conservatives basically get rid of council housing so that they could try and win back the inner cities. I think it's actually had a disastrous impact on the wider economy. And you know, it's common sense, actually, having social housing, council housing. As John Keeley, the Liberal Democrat councillor, was saying earlier, why didn't the Labour government build a single council house in 13 years? Good question. His party is now in power. Are they going to build any? I wonder.
Well, don't you think this is all a little bit pie in the sky, though, Martin? Because there's very few council houses being built anymore, and this is just simply not going to happen.
It's interesting. Ed Balls, who's now the Shadow Chancellor in the election campaign for the leadership of the Labour Party, he started to speak outside the box and say, well, hang on a minute, if we're going to have an economic crisis, perhaps what we need to do is build a whole new generation of council houses, soak up slack in the construction industry, and put homeless people into houses, and thereby stimulate the economy. Now, that kind of thinking is where we will end up going in the end. All this stuff about cuts that people are talking about now, even John saying, well, we don't really want to cut, we're doing it because we've got no choice. Eventually people realise you can't cut your way out of a mess like this, you have to spend your way out. Now, you can't just spend your way out, you have to raise taxes. What you might have to do is raise taxes on the people who are living in the big houses in Sneyd Park, so that you can pay for people to live next door to them in council houses. But of course the people Sneyd Park ward, I don't suppose they vote Labour up there, do they?
Okay, is there anything we can do about the fact that this has just been, you know, a complete misuse of resources, it appears, here for 4 years? Something like £1 million?
Well, I imagine the people behind the decision, if they're officers or whatever, will have said, well, if we sell this bit of land, we will get more money from it than we would by renting it out as council housing.
Uh-huh.
And that more money will then allow us not to cut, I don't know, something else, social services, whatever. Yeah.
At which point the recession kicks in.
Well, yes, but I mean, at the same time, there is an argument. I mean, obviously, there's a case for putting people into council houses to give them a house, but the financial control in the council may be saying, but if we sold it off to the private sector, that would give us more of an income stream. Now, in actual fact, this is robbing Peter to pay Paul and all the rest of it. We actually need to spend more money on social infrastructure, including social housing, and we will have to do that in order to break the back of the recession, but we're not quite there yet. People are still talking in the old way about we can't afford this, we can't afford that. We've got to break with that. I mean, the gentleman who was speaking there about Keynes as a liberal economist before the war and during the war, I think we're going to have to start looking at those kind of ideas again. And we've just had a whole generation where people have basically ignored what I would regard as sensible economic policy, and that includes New Labour and includes the Conservatives. But eventually we'll come back to looking at it, because it's the only way forward.
Well, Martin Summers, Old Labour Oxford economist, thank you very much.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Now, yesterday, Bristol's Colston Hall was a setting for an all-day event to address social inclusion and poverty. Entitled A World in Waiting, the free event involved representatives and decision-makers from many local organisations, as well as several hundred members of the public. Organisers used an open space format, whereby participants determined the agenda and discussed solutions towards a fairer future through lots of conversations that took place around the venue. BCFM were there to speak to attendees and observers, one of whom was George Bell from the Department of Work and Pensions, and he's also a policy advisor for the European Year for Combating Poverty. Well, good luck to him. Our reporter Andrew Parsonage first asked him why this event was happening here in Bristol.
This is an event that was formed by June Burroughs at the Peer and Centre to look at everything the European Year has done in the last 12 months and to have a look at some of the successes that we've achieved. The launch was here in Bristol. By the courtesy of Bristol County Council, we had a launch here for the year as a whole, and it's then developed from there. And what June wanted to do is bring as many of those people together since the launch and discuss some of the achievements and perhaps some policy issues that can be taken to central government.
Will you actually take anything from today, any sort of tangible changes or ideas?
Yes, there's lots come out through the European year, through all the events that have been held up and down the country. But there's been quite a bit that's come out of here today where people have been discussing, in some cases, similar issues that we were discussing up and down the country. And particularly today, where we've had some developments on some of those ideas. So people have got very strong ideas about how to combat poverty and how we're going to achieve the target by eradicating poverty by 2020, certainly child poverty. And that's a big task, and therefore all ideas are welcome so we can put them forward.
There was a speech earlier which talked about back in 2000 how the EU then had aspirations for 2010, and there's been a realisation that some of those, if many of those haven't been met, particularly around child poverty. They're setting out a vision for 2020, so how will that be any different to the last 10 years in terms of trying to achieve something?
You've got to have targets to achieve, and this is a very ambitious target, but certainly, even though we may be certainly worse off now than we were 2 years ago, the circumstances are we've still got to look at how various elements of poverty can be removed from such a wealthy country, and we are one of the wealthiest countries in Europe and one of the wealthiest in the world.
And finally, people are quite wary about the term consultation. Do you think the EU will genuinely listen to the voices of people like those here in Bristol?
The EU as a whole is listening to all the events that have occurred in all 26 countries that have taken part in this European year. And the information is now on their websites, and it is going to be looked at in detail because there's been some very good ideas right across Europe, and very good ideas that we could look at as well, plus some of the ideas that our country has had. The views can be useful in each country, and therefore they can be adopted into policy.
George, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
That was George Bell there from the Department for Work and Pensions. He's also policy advisor for the European Year for Combating Poverty, talking to BCFM's reporter Andrew Parsonage. Now, Martin, can you just give us an idea of whether you think there's any point to this? Because as Andrew was pointing out there, it's a little bit worrying, isn't it? Because the EU has failed to meet all its previous poverty reduction targets. So can we expect any better this time?
Well, I mean, you can aspire to reducing poverty, but then the overall policy that you're pursuing and the economic conditions under which you're pursuing it will determine the outcome. And we've run both the EU, Britain, the world as a get-rich-quick scheme for the wealthy classes for 30 years. And, of course, poverty has increased. I mean, I used to be an East European advisor, and without a shadow of a doubt, many people are poorer today than they were even 20 years ago under the communists. And that is a huge indictment of the policies that are being pursued.
On a wider scale, I mean, looking at the world the way it is at the moment, with your at least a bit of insight anyway into economics, do you think we're looking at quite a serious situation with poverty? Because it's generally speaking,
the
division in society seems to be widening and widening all the time.
Indeed it is. And it's, of course, people's inability to make ends meet is one of the factors underpinning the uprising in Egypt and elsewhere. We've now got commodity markets, futures markets, forcing up the price of wheat, for example, which means that people who were coping can't cope now because the bread, their daily bread is becoming too expensive for them. In countries like Egypt, you've got 40% youth unemployment, and this not just in the developing world. In the developed world, we still have not pockets of poverty, but growing poverty, because the economic system basically has now been rigged in favour of the lucky few at the top. And this is bound to lead to all kinds of social tensions and potentially violence, isn't it?
Okay, well, thanks for your insight into that. And now, MI5 and the Christmas Tree Files, secret political vetting at the BBC, as part of our series on censorship. The press is every day becoming more and more powerful, for good or evil. Its influence on men's minds has become so marked that it may with truth be said the press rules public opinion rather than public opinion rules the press. That was an extract from J. Arthur Gibbs, A Cotswold Village, Country Life and Pursuits in Gloucestershire, written over a century ago. When was it then that the TV entertainment stopped and the infotainment began? This week we look for the first time at MI5. Who are they and why have they been vetting BBC staff? Are they a law unto themselves? Well, to answer that question we go back to a book written in 1988 by now Guardian security correspondent Richard Norton Taylor. The book was Blacklist, the inside story of political vetting by Mark Hollingsworth and, as I said, Richard Norton Taylor. Chapter 5 was entitled MI5 and the BBC, Stamping the Christmas Tree Files. The chapter begins with a quote by Sir Hugh Green, who's Director General of the BBC from 1960 to 69. It was reported in the Sunday Times on the 20th of February 1977, and he said, and I quote, "One thing I can state quite categorically is that there has never been any victimisation of anyone for their political views at the BBC." If ever there was an example of security factors being used as a pretext for political vetting, it is the BBC. When their security procedures were revealed in 1985, the corporation said that vetting was restricted to a relatively small number of people who had access to sensitive information. But in reality, a large number of BBC employees, ranging from graduate trainees and journalists to arts producers and drama directors, were vetted by MI5 via the BBC Personnel Department, or Human Resources. Perhaps the most graphic illustration of this was the attempt to blacklist Roland Joffé, one of Britain's most distinguished film and television directors. His track record includes The Killing Fields, for which Joffé received an Academy Award nomination, and The Mission, which won him the top prize at the 1986 Cannes Film Festival. In the spring of 77, he was commissioned by the BBC to direct The Spongers, a new play about the failures of the welfare state and the desperate struggle of one woman caught in the poverty trap. The play's author was Jim Allen and its producer was Tony Garnett. Garnett informed the BBC's drama department that he wanted to hire Joffé as the director, but there was an unusually long delay in confirming his appointment. Eventually, Garnett was summoned by Sean Sutton, head of drama, to his fifth floor office at Television Centre, Wood Lane. Garnett had always had a frosty relationship with the corporation's top executives. He'd deliberately chosen an office on top of the East Tower, inverted commas in quotes here, to be as far away from management as possible. Close quotes. But he walked into Sutton's office that afternoon. As he did so, he was little prepared for what his head of drama was about to tell him. Sutton looked distinctly uncomfortable. "There is a problem," he said, "with Joffé's contract. He hasn't got BH, that is Broadcasting House, clearance." Astonished, Garlett asked why. Sutton refused to give a reason except to mutter, "It was the man in the Mac in Broadcasting House." Garnett stormed out and went straight to see Alastair Milne, who was then the managing director of BBC Television. Milne confirmed there was a problem and tried to placate Garnett by offering him a glass of whisky. But Garnett was seething and he said he would go public if the veto on Joffé's appointment was not withdrawn. "If you want all this business to come out, then it's in your hands. If you don't hire Joffé, then I'm off as well. And imagine what that would look like if I walked out in the middle of my contract." Milne said nothing, so Garnett continued, "If this continues to happen, then I won't be able to hire the people I want, which is my job as a producer." Milne did not argue. He picked up the phone and rang Sutton. "Hire Joffé," he snapped. Joffé's contract was confirmed, and the Spongers became a big success, winning that year's prestigious Pre-Italia Award. The problem with Joffé's appointment was that the BBC's personnel department had, according to Garnett and the head of plays, James Keflin Jones, branded the director a security risk because of his political views. This accusation was based on the fact that Joffé had attended a Workers' Revolutionary Party meeting in the early 1970s. Like many dramatists at the time, he was briefly interested in the WRP, but he was never a party member. And by 1977, he'd long severed his association with it. Joffé describes himself as a left-winger and says, "I was very interested in politics at the time, interested in what all the political parties were doing, not just the WRP, and I was never actively involved." Film producer and Social Democratic Party supporter David Putnam says of Joffé's politics, "Roland would have had nothing to do with the ideologies of the hard left. He detests that kind of imposition on the human spirit. He's a member of the Labour Party and a socialist in the humanist sense. His heart is in sync with his mind." The attempts to blacklist Joffé had nothing to do with the BBC's drama department. Recommendation had come from the personnel department instead, on the advice of MI5. It was part of a highly secretive political vetting which the BBC had been practising right back since 1937, a situation only reformed in 1986 after considerable public pressure. The system meant that all news and current affairs journalists, film editors, directors and producers in every department were vetted by MI5. It was run from room 105, a secluded office on the first floor of Broadcasting House, part of the same network of corridors on which George Orwell had modelled his Ministry of Truth in 1984. There, the BBC employed a security liaison officer who received the names of all successful job applicants from the chairman of interviewing boards. Then, the vetting, which BBC speak became known as colleging, or the formalities, took place. All BBC employees had a personnel file which included their basic personal details and work record, but there was also a second file. This included security information collected by Special Branch and MI5, who have always kept political surveillance on subversives in the media. So if a staff member was shortlisted for a job, this second file was handed to the department head, who had to sign for it. The file was a buff folder with a round red sticker stamped with the legend "Secret" and a simple symbol which looked like a Christmas tree. On the basis of information in this file, the personnel office recommended whether the person in question should be given the job or not. Former senior BBC executive recalls seeing one journalist's security file stamped with a Christmas tree symbol. For about 12 years, it recorded notes such as, "Has description to Daily Worker," or, "Our friends say he associates with communists and CND activists." It's fair to say there were contemporary memos from personnel officials adding they thought this was ridiculous, but it was all still on file. The names of outside job applicants were submitted directly to C branch of MI5. They were then passed on to the F branch domestic subversion, whose F7 section looks at political extremists, including MPs, lawyers, teachers and journalists. After consulting the registry of files, the names were fed into MI5's computer, which contains the identities of about a million subversives. Once MI5 had vetted an applicant, their decision was given in writing to the BBC's personnel office. MI5 never gave reasons for their recommendations, but quite often, if they said a person was a security risk, that was enough to blacklist him or her permanently. And that was an extract from MI5 and the Christmas Tree Files, Secret Political Vetting at the BBC. The Christmas Tree is also a reference to the tune of The Red Flag, indicating someone has left-wing tendencies. And so the book was Blacklist, The Inside Story of Political Vetting by Mark Hollingsworth and Richard Norton Taylor, published by the Hogarth Press in 1988. Now, Martin, what are the implications of this kind of thing, given that this is actually a long time ago? One of the things that bothers me is the fact that if somebody is being vetted for a job, that actually no reason is actually given.
Well, yes, and if you remember a few years ago, there was a famous blacklist run by the Economic League of trade union activists who found that mysteriously they couldn't get work. And we were talking about construction workers here rather than and people of that sort rather than journalists and teachers. It's very hard to deal with a situation where the powers that be basically keep files on people and ruin people's lives and careers without any accountability, isn't it?
It's a bit like you know the credit card rating business. At least now you have a right to go and see the reasons that someone has given at one of these credit card rating agencies for not giving you a credit rating. Not necessarily the same case there, is it? Because you don't have access to your own MI5 file.
No, you don't. I mean, obviously, there's always going to be a need for some kind of secret police work, if you like.
Well, what is that need?
Well, the need is very, very limited. Very limited. I mean, I remember when I used to work in the Balkans as an aid worker, people would say, well, look, you know, we've got to have some kind of secret police here because, you know, this is a very complicated situation. People are fighting and dying. There's a necessary need for some element of spying to go on. But, of course, the point is that this should be accountable in some way, and the suspicion is, of course, that the intelligence services in Britain and elsewhere are not accountable and in fact have got their own agenda. When I say their own agenda, it's the agenda of their real masters, who are possibly in Washington, possibly in Wall Street, possibly in the Pentagon. And this is what's worrying, is that there's no accountability. Somebody, for example, might be banned from getting jobs for years and not realise why they can't get the jobs. This is why perhaps you need something like a written constitution, which will tell you what it is legitimate for the security services to do and what is not legitimate.
So how widespread do you think this is, not just in broadcasting, but in other parts of industry, that there is actually a place that potential employers can then submit, you know, names to before they even shortlist people for an interview?
Well, I mean, I mean, the Economic League was a private organisation that was blacklisting potential trade unionists.
And I seem to remember that the Economic League announced, with kind of trumpets, that it was actually closing down. And then it was found that the same people who'd been running that had actually started a new company called something else, Caprim.
Indeed.
CAPRIM.
I mean, if private organisations want to set up, you know, what you might call private spying. There probably needs to be some regulation of that, but it's hard for to argue that they couldn't want to investigate people's politics if that's what they wanted to do. But what's really insidious is, of course, that they're getting access to the state's files. The Economic League was not getting its information from private sources; it was getting it from the state.
So, do you think?
I would argue that there's got to be an absolute division between the state spying for its own purposes and private spying for private purposes. And there must be no look at this Mark Kennedy police officer spying on the Green Movement for many years, and then decided to go as a government employee, and then decides to go freelance and sell his services freelance to a private corporations.
Well, the key word there is sell, isn't it? Do you think it's even feasible that security information kept on us by security services, MI5, people like that gets sold?
It's absolutely unacceptable that the state collecting information on people for its own purposes, that any of that information should be made available to private employers. Completely unacceptable and absolute abuse.
But I mean, I can remember reading an article in Independent a few years ago where the head of MI6 at the time was actually having a conference in London saying, you know, what information can we sell you to heads of industry?
Well, this is one of the problems, isn't it, with this whole idea of cooperation between the public and the private sectors and all the rest of it. It sounds rather innocuous, but it's not innocuous. It's potentially very damaging.
Well, Martin, thank you very much. That's all for this week. Thanks very much for our guest in the first hour. That was Lib Dem councillor for Easton, John Keeley. And thanks also to reporter Marina Morris. And next week we have Brian Leslie, who's a long-time monetary reformer in here, from 6 o'clock. Thanks very much for joining us. Our website, thisweek.org.uk. See you next week.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol.